world within its own kind. We know, for example, the experiments made with labyrinths and plants. A labyrinth created, very complicated one, with many false turns and so on, and completely covered. And a vine was placed at the beginning of this labyrinth. And there was no way for it to grow back. The labyrinth was closed behind it. The only way it could reach the light that it needed to survive was to make at least a dozen or 15 turns in strange, blind-ended passageways, of which only one led to the light. And the light might be behind a dozen or more blinds and false turns. And the experiments show that the plant, in every case, without hesitation or without doubt, developed directly through the correct passageways and straight to the light. This indicates something. No one seems to know just what, but it seems to indicate that the plant, and certainly a higher form of life, the animal, has a certain ability to direct and dominate its own career and purposes so that it can accomplish that which is necessary to its own survival. We find this all through the plant kingdom. We know the palm tree in the desert will drop a taproot 60 feet down through the sand to reach water. All of these things indicate some form of wise and protective government. Now, Gautama Buddha and many of the Orientalists who were much given to the use of fables regarded them more or less as indications of latent potentials within the human being. The human being has powers and faculties which we do not use and mostly do not understand. In Buddhism and Hinduism both, it is assumed that every power of every creature inferior to man exists also within man. That the human being has within himself every potency of knowledge, every skill, every ability, every vital resource that can be represented by any animal, plant, or even the fission of minerals. The human being, therefore, is a tremendously complicated creature. It has all the kingdoms, the mineral, the vegetable, the animal, and its own, within its structure. And in the process of the prenatal epoch, the embryo passes through all of these stages. As a result of that, the Oriental pays great attention to the subtle indications of powers and propensities that are overlooked. The Oriental, Buddhism and Hinduism both, assume that man in his development, in his human development, has emphasized those faculties and powers which were most convenient to his purposes. He was in a material environment. Therefore, he developed all types of external functions. He became able to build houses and to do all kinds of labors, to perfect arts and sciences, but always because of the pressure of environment. It was the outside that was molding him. It was the outside that was transforming him. And it was to fulfill the outside that he dedicated all of his internal resources. Those resources which did not immediately profit him economically or did not lead immediately to a security for his physical existence were simply ignored. But gradually, of course, man developing further and further in his own unfoldment, became increasingly aware of new needs within himself. He found that it would be highly convenient to have certain extrasensory perceptions if he could develop them. He also began to realize that in the building of a great external, he had completely impoverished the internal, that his inner life was weak, and that he was depending for his existence upon an outer life that was not sufficiently secure to protect him or give him the growth that he needed. Therefore, in India and many other places, the problem of releasing internal became more and more important. And in the releasing of internal, it seemed to be that these internal pressures and processes could be symbolized in various ways. In Indian mythology, we have an elaborate symbolism of deities that are really only aspects of human consciousness. We had among the Greeks the same thing. They were fully aware that the legends and myths and stories of their Olympian gods were actually derived from pressures within themselves, that these deities were symbols of powers within man. In the museum in Baroda in India, I saw a magnificent example of religious ingenuity. A descent of a family, several generations of a family, worked upon a tremendous pattern, a cosmic kind of pattern of the universe and the human body. It was painted on fabric. If I remember, the painting was about 2 feet wide and 10 or 12 feet long. On this, every aspect of life was represented by appropriate deities. Every nerve end had a godling on it. Every muscle was part of a structure of a being in itself. And in this system, it was assumed that the cells, the various structures of the body, constituted a complete world of inhabited beings. That in this body of man, every type of creature known to our environment also existed symbolically and microscopically. That every cell had an integrity as much and as real as anything the composite being could produce. So if this were true, it then became obvious to the ancient that all these parts of the individual had their own laws, that they had certain rights and privileges, that there isn't a drop of blood in man that doesn't have rights, that hasn't responsibilities and opportunities. And the government of the composite human being has to be a righteous government to protect the rights and privileges and inalienable opportunities of these minute creatures. So to cover the body with all kinds of symbolic beings simply represented the efforts of the ancient to find out the dispositions and temperaments of the microorganisms that constitute together the human function. These were some of the animals. These are the sacred animals in antiquity. And each one of these is subject to abuses, subject to misdirections and misuse, subject to neglect, and all of this body with all its minute parts is under the dangerous government of self-centered, avaricious, ambitious human beings who are perfectly willing to sacrifice the lives within their bodies in order to advance their personal ambitions. So that man's body is actually under the rule of a ruthless dictatorship, like the heron who ate the frogs. The human body is made up of functions that have their own rights, just as levels of society, as nations, as races, as cultures, have their own prerogatives, their own inalienable privileges. Man, ignoring all of the rights of the inside of his own body, of the creatures that inhabit him, and make his life possible, then falls into the most dangerous of all delusions and ends in sickness. The neglected parts rise in rebellion, and we have revolution and anarchy. Or these neglected parts simply die, setting up a decomposition that ultimately destroys the whole fabric. No one can break the rules, and the rules of life are almost all of them set forth in legends, myths, fables, and various symbolical representations. It was assumed that in this way the individual could achieve the understanding of them and could recognize their meaning, their true meaning. Now, in the Egyptian mysteries, and in some of the other legend countries also, such as Tibet, Bhutan, and Nepal, the religious rites of the countries include masks. And these masks are mostly animal masks. And under the control of the temples where these designs originated and are maintained, these masks are worn by the actors when they perform certain cosmic dramas. Now, in Tibet, for instance, the animal masks are used very heavily to indoctrinate the people with the principles of Buddhism. It's interesting to note that in Tibet there is no fictional literature. There are no stories in Tibet. There are none of the horse operas and so forth that we have in the West. No penny dreadfuls and no dime novels. To the Tibetan, it's all very simple. If it isn't true, it isn't worth reading. And instead of fiction, they have what they might term a kind of true fictional interpretation of values and lives. They use true incidents and facts dramatically. They dramatize the common processes of living. And they also use their so-called literature, of which there is very little secular literature, to explain and expound the various doctrines and philosophies of their faiths. This is, in a sense, the same thing that you have in the fable. The Egyptian deities with their animal and bird masks conceal beneath their appearances meanings. And there is a suggestion that it is possible that the fables of Aesop were strongly influenced by the ritual mysteries of the rites of Isis and Osiris in Egypt. We find the same mysteries still practiced among the Indians of our southwest, where the Kachina masks include many animal forms. And these animal forms are humanized in ritual to represent the contributions of various forms of life in nature and to remind us forever that there is nothing in nature that is actually ignorant. What we call ignorance is something that's peculiar to the human being, because other kingdoms have built-in intelligence which they cannot go against. This built-in intelligence is we call instinct. And instincts gradually evolve until they become intuitions. Instincts are the beginnings of knowledge, and they arise from our own innate integrities, these built-in truths that nothing can actually destroy. We interpret these truths as instincts to begin with, and these instincts become morally involved in the concept of conscience, but always behind a decision that is not artificially distorted, there is a natural integrity. And if the individual can follow the instinct that he has without allowing it to be distorted by some emotional or mental factor, he will find that his instincts lead him always in the way of truth. They lead him toward the explanation and solution of the mystery of himself. In the Aesop fables, we have some fables in which, apparently, all does not go well with the instinct patterns. We find some in which, apparently, scheming and strategy have a very large part to play. But even in these, the various creatures involved show a distinct tendency to build up a concept, a general understanding. First of all, we might call the ravenous factor, the wolf. The wolf is always a danger. And the old legends of the wolf we find in Aesop come back to us again in Little Red Riding Hood, which is almost certainly a story derived from India. In this we have the wolf disguising itself to represent the grandmother. Actually, the wolf in the fables of Aesop always represents a natural or basic destructive tendency. The wolf is a savage, and it fulfills its own savagery. And the struggle of the human being against savagery is represented by its ability to outwit the wolf. Now, the wolf in ourselves is also something to take into consideration. The wolf in ourselves is usually a wolfishness in which, regardless of what happens, we want to have our own way. The wolf is therefore a factor in man which causes human beings to prey upon each other, on the understanding or on the concept that this is natural, normal, and proper. And in the fables, the wolf is always the villain, and its villainy is always so clearly received and so clearly understood that even small children, hearing the fables, realize that the wolf stands for something that is not true. Wolf is brute force. It is the strength of the forest. It is the power to pursue and destroy life. The next factor of group of factors in the story are the foxes. Now, the foxes are not as bad as the wolves. The foxes are more cunning. The fox is very protective. It wants to take care of itself. It wants to have its own way. But it is not going to get a face-on collision with a wolf. The fox, therefore, instead of representing brute force, he represents cunning, the ability to plot and to plan to get its own way with little or no dangerous consequences. Now, there are many people who live as foxes. They live off of their wits. They live off of their power to exploit others and consider it perfectly reasonable and perfectly proper to cheat for the sake of having what they want. The fox, therefore, is also cunning. It is able to use its faculties to achieve a variety of ends. Now, in the fables of Aesop, the fox is not always evil. Sometimes it is a frustrated animal that tries to find ways to fulfill the needs of its own survival. But in substance, the fox represents not the open danger, but a more or less subtle danger arising from misrepresentation or falsification of values. In the same situation, we have the frogs. Now, the frogs, apparently, that concept in Aesop originated from the Dionysian and Eleusinian mysteries, and we remember the play The Frogs by Aristophanes, in which a chorus of frogs accompanies the candidate as he goes through the rituals of the rites and of the Eleusinian mysteries. Now, the frogs in the story are nearly always a noisy lot. They are heard from all the time. Also, in one of the fables of Aesop, a frog is so determined to be bigger than it is that it keeps puffing itself up in order to get larger and larger and larger, and the more it puffs and blows, the more difficulty it has in breathing and all that type of thing, but it is going to be bigger than anything else, no matter what it costs. So, in the due course of time, it goes on getting bigger and bigger until finally it bursts. Now, the frog in this case certainly represents a certain type of human being. And in the fable of Aesop, it represents the individual who tries to be what he is not, who tries to be bigger than himself. He wants to be powerful, he wants to be rich, he wants to do all the things that larger and better equipped creatures indulge in, and he tries and tries and tries and ultimately destroys himself. So that the fable is, be moderate, do what you can, but never compete with that which is beyond you. Do not compete with something over which you have no control, or try to be bigger than you are. There is a very good old phrase that comes from the deep south, where there's a statement that says, there's no use trying to be what you ain't, Because no matter what you try to be, you are what you is. And this is the more or less the burden of the story of the frog. It is to be quiet and proper in relationships and not attempt to overdo any of the propensities of life. The frogs, therefore, are in a pond. They do not amount to too much. And their various sounds and noises can be called vox populi, the voice of the people. They're there, and they're living their own little lives in the ponds, in ponds. Now, these ponds can be nations. It doesn't make any difference how big the pond is. Remember always in the fable that the chief frog, the one that is the ruler of the pond, considers itself to be the most important thing in the whole world, even though the pond is only 10 feet across. So you can get great satisfaction from a small empire. And some people would much prefer to be a big frog in a small puddle than to be a small frog in a big puddle. Because everything likes to have some form of authority or power. And this depends largely upon the environment. The larger the environment, the more is demanded of those who wish to excel or assume proportions of leadership. But there are very few people who do not want to lead in something. So the frogs are always present and are important to the legends and myths. Now the birds also are very interesting. Probably the most important bird in the Aesop fables group is the heron. This is a bird that looks like a stork. It has long legs and a long beak, and it has all kinds of requirements, and it lives very largely by living from creatures that have no actual form of defense. So that the heron, with its own peculiar equipment, it very often gets into conflict with foxes and other creatures that are differently integrated. And there is one of the fables, of course, about the fox and the heron, in which the fox invites the heron to dinner. And when the heron arrives, all of the food is served in shallow, flat bowls, and the heron can't get its beak into it and get any, so it has no dinner. Then the heron says, it's my turn to return this compliment. You have invited me to dinner, so I will now invite you to dinner. And when the fox comes to dinner at the heron's house, everything is in tall, thin vases that the heron's beak can get, and the fox goes hungry. Now, there's a social significance in this point also. And in our human relationships, this type of situation, a sort of a vengeance over the dinner table, is not unknown. We also have a tendency to arrange our affairs so that our own peculiar tastes are the ones that are most likely to be gratified. In conversation, we like to talk about the subjects we are interested in. In business, we want to be in the business that we are most proficiently adapted for. So each individual sets up a world of its own, and in that world, everything is adjusted to the particular temperament of that individual. Now, we understand this all right, and we don't have any great offense against it, but it is very wise to realize that in following this pattern, we place unreasonable limitations upon ourselves. We lock ourselves more and more in a world in which we can feed, but from which we exclude all others. And when we go out to feast with someone else and they serve us their meal, we are apt to disagree with them because their meal may consist of their political allegiances, their religious allegiances, their hobbies, their beliefs, their doctrines, and their families, and all of the personal things of life, and the visitor is unable to gain any nutrition from the meeting. So the more specialized the individual becomes, the less he is able to adjust to the thoughts and attitudes of others. It is much better if we take the various foods and ideas which we have and put them in vessels of such shapes that all others can more or less feed with us out of the same bowls. This is very true in philosophy, for example, where it is very important to have beliefs and doctrines that you can share with people. If the beliefs and doctrines are too different, then one of the possible contributing parties is left out. So it is always wise to serve food in a jar or a vessel which is so shaped that all can gain proper nutrition. And this means that in philosophy or in religion, that the doctrines are such that they can be shared by others. That there is nothing in our way of life that is so completely separate from others that we live in an isolation caused by the restriction of our own viewpoints. Many orthodoxies of one kind or another have this tendency. They demand allegiance. They demand agreement. They demand that you eat the same food and that you take it from the vessel that fits them the best rather than the vessel which may be useful to you. This type of thinking was well known to the Greeks and to most ancient peoples. Now, we also have a legend or a fable about fish. Once upon a time, there was a fisherman who was also a musician, and he loved to play the bagpipe. So he would sit down by the edge of the shore, start playing a dance tune on his bagpipe, and demand that the fishes should dance. They beautifully and completely ignored him, paying absolutely no attention and minding their own business, as all well-behaved fish ought to do. Finally, exasperated with this situation, he put aside his musical instrument, got a net, and caught a lot of fish. And as soon as he used the net, they were caught. And while they were in the net along the edge of the shore, he started to play his music again, and now all the fishes danced. And the moral of the story was very simple. When you're in a predicament, such as the fish were in after they were caught, you do what you're told. You agree with your adversary quickly. So the fish danced when they had to, but they had no heart for it, actually. Now, we do this with people. We have various rules and so forth which people obey, but they have no real heart for them. We have to capture them first, hold them down, and force our will upon them. And there is nothing that human beings like to do better than to capture each other. They like to gain a control so that they can force other people to do what they're told to do. This is very largely true in governments and very fantastically true in families, where some member of a family wants to play the music and all the others must dance. And the only way to get them to dance, perhaps, is to include them in your will. And if you've left them a large sum of money, it is a moral responsibility to dance for you. And in that way, they capture you and gain a control over your life, which is not fair, but very common. Also, they have a very good story in the Aesop's Fables about the dog that insisted on sleeping in the ox's manger. The ox had a nice stall and a box with his food in it. And this dog sat on the food and just barked. It didn't want the food, couldn't eat it, didn't want it, had no interest in it. But it just wanted to stay there because the ox wanted the food. It was a case of taking a certain joy in preventing somebody else from enjoying themselves. And also to make life difficult and obnoxious by bad disposition. So the fable very definitely points out that there are certain persons with temperaments that have no interest in certain things, but they are determined that others shall not have them or enjoy them. So they remain as dogs in the manger. They do not want it themselves, but they are determined that no one else will have it. This situation has led to a well-known adage, of course, that we all refer to quite frequently when we meet with difficult or objectionable people. Now, dogs also have a part to play in the fable world, because from very early times, dogs have been very close to human beings and have served them in many capacities. Many of the fables, including involving dogs, are quite humanized and quite adorable and pleasant in many, many cases. We find also that the horse and the jackass play important parts in fables because they are domesticated animals with which we have contact. Also, the farmyard has its legends and its fables. Once upon a time, there was a rooster, and it was a very handsome and very regal rooster that really ruled its roost without any doubt. And it was pecking away and cutting and scratching in the barnyard when it came upon a pearl. And the rooster looked at the pearl for a moment. Didn't mean very much to the rooster. So he looked at it, turned away, kept on scratching until he found some grain, and the grain made him very happy, but the pearl did nothing for him. And the moral of the very brief little statement is that you don't enjoy anything that you don't understand. Everything that is meaningless to you maybe has great meaning to someone else, but that only is worthwhile which you understand and for which you have immediate use. And if you are, for example, like the rooster in the barnyard, if you have a great deal of interest in your family, your home, your business, and you're going along day by day fulfilling these normal responsibilities, you are not interested in abstract culture. You can live your whole life without ever studying art or music or anything of that kind because it isn't part of your world. So the rooster and the pearl tells us that what isn't part of your world is of no interest to you. And yet sometimes the things that are of no interest are the most valuable of all. But they are only valuable to those who understand them and want them or need them. So in the story of the rooster and the pearl, you have the story of human appreciation. Why it is that some people can have the great aesthetic delight over some beautiful object which is meaningless to someone else. And also perhaps has something to do with our modern trends today, in which in art particularly and in music and in all these things, we have extreme mediocrity. Why? Because there is little basic interest in beauty. If beauty was valued, the rooster would have picked up the pearl. If beauty was valuable to us, we would not permit deformity to be recognized and glorified. But because we're not much interested, we leave it to as it is and go pecking for some food or seeds that we do understand. But the motto, of course, of the basic thought underlying it all is that what we do not appreciate is worthless. And each individual has to judge his appreciation for himself. He cannot derive it from other people. And so as we go through these different fables and legends, we find a great deal of very homely wisdom. We found a great many thoughts that we can interpret in terms of the present day. And if you've never read a version of Aesop's Fables, it might well do you to take a look and see how you could interpret the symbolism, how you can say what those fables mean to you, and how in one way or another they challenge you or ask something of you. They want you to do something a little differently, maybe a little better. they want you also to recognize the rewards of good actions and bad actions, and to recognize the importance of integrities under the pressure of stress and temptation. All these fables together are very interesting and delightful, and if the truth were known, they were probably gathered from practically every cultural system in the world, and they were projected through every generation for the last 3,000 years, or very nearly that long. Therefore, they give us a cross-section of what we have really thought, what we have really believed, and what we think we know, and how long we have held these thoughts. One thing that may help us a little from these fables is that the people of long ago were very much like ourselves. They had the same problems. They faced them in various ways as we do. But the fables would indicate that even in those days, there was a great determination to do it better. There was a great requirement to grow and to overcome the weaknesses of human nature. There was violent outburst against dishonesty. There was a strong sense of morality. These things have not changed. They have gone on from generation to generation. And what we call the old world is nothing but the same as the new world, but it has been there a longer time. There is no real essential difference in the integrities of life. If we keep them, they keep us. If we break them, they break us. And this pattern of integrities is probably best presented to our direct attention through fables, legends, myths, and all these strange fragments that have come down to us derived from the thoughtfulness of long ago. If, therefore, we find these interesting and intriguing, it certainly will be well worth our while to pick up an edition of Aesop. It's in print and always has been, and see what these mean in terms of thoughtful understanding in your own life of the principles that underlie fables, and how these fables can help you to correct situations that need attention in your daily activities. It's an interesting and, I think, a stimulating thought. Well, I guess that's all we can do this morning, but I'd like to make an announcement, and that is that next Sunday morning, of course, as you know, Dr. Irwin has passed on, and Mr. McIntosh, who was a very close friend of John and was interested in all the areas of Dr. Irwin's selection for next Sunday's lecture, is going to take it and carry it on as John himself would probably have handled it. So we thank that Mr. McIntosh, who is also a trustee of the society. Also this afternoon, or at 1 o'clock, or very shortly thereafter, we're going to have a little memorial service here for John Irwin, and we are inviting all of you who would like to attend to be with us, and there will be an interesting factor in this. Andre Bello, who was John Irwin's protege in music, and has done great things in the advancement of his knowledge of the violin, and is really John's godson, is going to play at this memorial this afternoon, and you're all invited to attend. Many of you have heard Mr. Balog playing and know that he is really an extraordinary musician, a young man who already has a worldwide reputation. We hope you'll all attend this little service beginning at approximately 1 o'clock. We thank you for being with us this morning and hope also that you will be able to hear our good friend next Sunday morning. Thank you very much.